Greetings, everyone. We are happy that you've tuned in to Stargate Roundtable, and we look forward to having a very interesting evening. We have an author on for our guest tonight, and we will begin, as we always do, with setting the tone and the energy for the evening with our dear little Angel Sue. So I pass the talking stick to you, Angel Sue.
Thank you very much, Marita Robert, and welcome to all. In the light of the most radiant one, in the office of the Christ, and only in the office of the Christ. And we're invoking the loving energies of Saint Germain and the violet flame here now. So claim yourself as that beloved child that you are. And call in your support team. With all the beautiful beings that you are a part of, your higher self, your twin flame, your guides, masters, your teachers, your angels, your councils of light, and all those from the lighted realms that celebrate your path of just you being here on the planet at this time, this place, this space. And if you will, just take in a big, deep breath that you share with every one of them. All those beautiful beings and the beautiful being that you are. Allow pure, unconditional divine love, whatever you claim that for yourself to be, to come in with your breath, and as the breath leaves, share gratitude that goes out to each aspect of our planet, within, upon, and around. This beautiful light fills with each breath with your intention and leaves with that gratitude, sharing, love with all. And if you will just set your intent that this goes on automatic pilot, take one more breath in and allow energy to start swirling through every cell and every atom of that love, growing greater and brighter, more light, more love. And let it exit now. The true understanding of what gratitude can accomplish. So if you'll check within yourself, I'm asking you to check the pulse, the vibration, the aspect of what you are right now. From the top of your head down to the bottom of your feet. And we're just going to open up a new circuit. We'll use an old-fashioned light switch with the up and the down aspect. Remember? We don't always have those anymore, but light switches, we're going to switch on all of your concerns with the perfect divine solution. And we'll use those words, praise, respect, thank, and love, and let it just, with our intent, with our understanding that there's a happy, perfect, divine solution for everything that's going on within our hearts, within our minds, within our spirits, within our emotions. Switch that solution on and know that it will be answered in the perfect way. And as you think now, press your thoughts into the people that you care about, that you claim. All of their concerns and situations. All the beings that you celebrate in your heart. The animals, the birds, the planet. Let's even go out into the aspect of Nasara, the Reformation Act, and our Faction 3 White Knights, and our galactic forces of light, and all beings that you're aware of, and more that you have carried in your understanding from the media, all things that you've heard about this week, even this day, this evening. White hats, dark hats, no hats. All beings. We're going to switch on that perfect, divine, happy solution for all of them to find peace, harmony, health, happiness, joy. Take another big, deep breath in and release when you're ready. And set your intention that all is blessed. Intend that the avatars, the masters, the angels, all beings that are working to bring heaven on earth now, our divinity, that it be lifted up by these beings through the Law of One, which we're about to do, and perfected in even better ways than we could dream of. So with this, we're going to say we are all one. We call in all those beings, known and unknown, seen and unseen, throughout all time and space, to find this happiness for ourselves, for all others. And so, when one is harmed, all are harmed. Yet, as one is helped, then all are helped. And we're going to pay it forward to everything that we can possibly dream of. So, in the name of who we are, and we are one with all there is, we ask that only that which is the highest good of all concerned happen here, throughout all time and space, past, present, future, parallels, potentials. All of creation, be blessed with this Law of One. And so we give thanks with grateful hearts, and we're going to close now by saying all men, all women, all children, all beings, all creation, we are all one. And thank you with all our hearts. So with this, Marita Robert, I pass the talking stick. Thank you.
Well, thank you, dear one, for getting us started and setting the tone for the evening. We appreciate you very much. So we will move on to the next segment here, understanding a little bit about what the energies of the Mayan calendar have, and our dear little Rainbird will share that with us. Caroline, are you there?
I am. Thank you, Marita, and I'll take that talk. Today, in the Mayan calendar, is a white resonant moon. I mean, not moon, wind. Excuse me, later. So this wind, eek, and it's a seventh, resonance of seventh. Seventh eek today. And that wind energy, that's that, the voice, listening to that voice of spirit. It's a visionary aspect. It's about co-creation, heaven on earth, and truth. All matter, and remembering unity with spirit. So this is the wind in which spirit takes you. Time to surrender to a personal and profound acknowledgement that spirit is at work inside and through you, co-creating heaven on earth for yourself and for others. So give up judgment, spirit work with others. Use unseen forces to inspire yourself to the truth in all matters. You're never separate from spirit. You are spirit's voice. The breath of life, pure and divine, flows through you, and you are unseen yet always present. You're both male and female. That focus alignment of the essence of pure spirit and the yin and the yang. So that's wind. So if that seven, that's definitely the most mystical tone of all of them. It is attunement, of channeling, and it's inspirational. So you are the light of the spinning seven chakras, and you have perfect and clear reception to Creator. So that's that seven energy work. And so today's a good day, and tomorrow we have a portal day. And those portal days are, the veils are thin, and the dimensions are multi. So work with that Friday energy, this portal day, and it is the night. Eight Akbal. Eight is that, it's that octave harmonic, or it's fine-tuning, it's galactic integrity, and about harmonizing. So with that good tone, it revisits that way we just went through Akbal, and that's the night. It's about our participation in our own abundance and our belief in our abundance and learning from the dream time. We use the protection of the night. And we work in that nighttime that way. So what a good little glyph for a portal day, a Friday night. So enjoy working with your abundance tomorrow, and know that it's multidimensional. So let's work with everybody's abundance. And then on Saturday we have a nine con, the seed. That seed is a healer aspect, and it's about us. That openness to life and self-determination and timing, harmony-seeking, and it gifts our possibility and potential of creation. So let's use that seed energy on Saturday as we engage in whatever projects we're working with. It's a nine tone, so that's about expanded greater cycles and expansion, completion. It's 3-3, so you're working with activation and in these greater cycles. So lots of good energy for Saturday to work in the garden. And then on Sunday, it's a 10 Xichang. I think Sunday's a full moon, but I'm not sure. But as a full moon day, a 10 manifesting.
I believe it's on Monday, the 12th.
Oh, okay.
No. Let's see. No, it's Tuesday.
Oh, it's Tuesday. Oh, well, good. Thanks. We'll discuss that in that context then. But Sunday is a 10 Xichang. Xichang is a serpent. It's about changing our skin, letting go what no longer serves as transformation, remaining open to change, transmuting energy. That serpent energy is very powerful, especially in healing aspects, but it is a warrior aspect of the Mayan calendar. So gifts are motivation to change and instinct and body sensing. So be in your body on Sunday and work with change and manifesting the changes that you want with that 10 energy of manifestation. Now Monday, an 11 Kimi. 11 is letting go of what no longer serves us, and Kimi is that linker of worlds. So let's let go of what no longer serves us in all of the worlds that we work in. And forgiveness and moving into a state of grace. Let's work with that energy on Monday. let go of that which is no more, and let go of the ego and the controlling behavior and the belief that life is a struggle. Let go of all that and embrace the gift of the world bridger, that bridge between the past and the future, and transmutation, again, more transmutation. And then on Tuesday, when we have the full moon, it is a 12, that crystal tone, and it's about complex stability. And Monique, the deer, or the hand, it's deer season right now, so I hope it's a good day for all of them. We appreciate their giveaway. And that hand, healing energy. So healing of self and others on Tuesday with this full moon energy creates contentment and peace. And accept the divinity of yourself. Carries the gift of the healer of humankind and the ability to open new doors. So you might consider that with this energy of the 12-tone complex stability, the unity of polarity. There's a lot going on with that. And it's just, it's a time to surrender distraction and belief in inadequacy and procrastination. So get on it on Tuesday without procrastinating and enjoy that beautiful day. And then on Wednesday, the 13th, Lamont, we complete the wave of the warrior, which is the wave that we're in right now on Wednesday. So this is a warrior wave that we're in. So remember that warrior aspect in your daily life each day this week as we go through this wave. And so 13 Lamont is the day we ended on Wednesday, and that's transmuting to Christ consciousness all that we've done in this wave and sending it off into that Stargate space with that Lamont energy. Isn't that a beautiful way to end a wave? So 13 is that transcendent energy. It's the universal movement of change. And then the Lamont is the Stargate, and it's a visionary aspect about illumination of humankind and opening the Stargate and journeying and that pioneer spirit and having the power to see beyond the gate. So play with those energies on Wednesday. And then when we come back on Thursday, we'll begin a new wave, and it'll be the wave of the loop, the moon. So that's the wave about purification. So schedule your purification event for next week. And also we enter into the Halloween season, which is a high Earth holiday. And so there you go. That's the energy for Thursday when we come back next week. And one, the loop. And that's the Mayan calendar for the week. Enjoy this week. It's been beautiful here. We've had a beautiful Indian summer. And I hope it doesn't get too cold. And I pass this talk stick right back to you, Marita. Your turn.
Well, thank you for helping us through this. And did you reschedule your conference calls, or is there anything that you need to tell us about that?
No, I will let you know when I have something. It'll be a couple
okay.
more weeks.
Okay, that's fine. Just didn't want to forget it if there was something that you needed to make an announcement for. So, and I've had a couple people call me this week, and they had asked about in September I had offered to do the transformational clearing for some people that had birthdays, and they asked me if that was going on for October, and yes, I will still honor that. And I also had made the announcement in September instead of the $95, I would for our Stargate Roundtable people, I would do it for $50. So if you wish to do that, I will still honor that the rest of this month. And that's you can email me at StargateMarita, M-A-R-I-E-T-T-A, mariettta@gmail.com. Or you can call me at 317-773-0061. Now, I know that there's a lot going on, and we are just anxious to hear what Tara and Rama have to tell us, to see if we can sort out what's really happening behind the scenes. So I pass the talking stick to you, Rama.
Greetings.
Greetings, everybody. Okay, and everybody, just do your best to make a contribution for this show, for Marita and Stargate Roundtable, and for all of us. Do your best to make a contribution. It's really a good karma and good dharma.
And, thank you for remembering to ask for that. I forget to do that. So, yes, our donations have been very slim in the last couple months, so we could use some help. Thank you.
Okay. And and I mean it, everybody. It's the best dharma you could do right now, because this is, as the Galactics have been saying, yes, they've been helping, yet they're not going to do it for us. And Bernie Sanders said it again.
Yeah.
We need tens of millions in a movement, a unified movement, to speak truth to power right now. It is becoming more and more and more obvious, the shenanigans, to say the least.
Yes.
Oh, my God. And yes, this was a dog and pony show today.
Yeah.
Yet on
11.
Another level, no. Because both sides are in the bed, in the dirt.
And, yeah.
And yes, there are 64 good members. That's it. Yet the underlying stuff is just completely distraction to the underlying stuff.
Yeah, the way I could describe it is the barn is so full of the, you know, that stuff, shoveling it out to get to the truth. It's going to take 11 hours like it did today.
Was it? I thought it was 8 hours.
No, it was 11 hours.
Oh, dear.
Yeah.
She looked a little bedraggled, to say the least.
Yeah, and Elijah Cummings, he honored Hillary, and he just said, you know, in not so many words, you were a lady and you didn't lose it. Thank you. And at the same time, I could see at certain point she wanted to lose it and she kept her cool. Tabitha. It's okay.
Come on. She'll get over it.
Yeah. Overall, this was another bread and circuses, as it is called, for the masses to distract us from what's really going on.
Yet Rana Moo talked to Rama along with Larry and Curly today.
Yes.
Go handle that. And said that Hillary knows full well how the chips fell in Benghazi. And that Rana Moo also said Hillary is in a very tight situation between the ocean of creation and the dark rift. And those two things are the same. They're called Mother Sekhmet. And Rana Moo said Hillary does not have the 800 metric tons of gold she stole from Gaddafi, and which she agreed to split among the top members of the 13 families as collateral to pay hired minions to do more black ops against the people of the world. And as we know, Saint Germain has it all in his hands. Hillary is being thrown under the bus by the higher echelons of the families, metaphorically speaking, meaning having to step before him and testify to with these Republican bread and circus show of the so-called Benghazi hearings. By this whole dog and pony fiasco, Republicans have wasted $5 million+ of taxpayers' good money. Yes, it looks like the Republicans have this egg on their face. Yet, in alternative news, all the Clinton crime stories are beginning to be brought back up, all the way back again, for deeper scrutiny. And that's the real purpose of all of this. And Al Jazeera did a bang-up job of it last night.
Yeah.
And they, you know, they said the wrong thing in the sense, like they said the... what do you call that when you hurt yourself, when you kill yourself? The suicide of Hillary's lover,
Vince Foster.
Yet now we're going to tell the whole truth about that, that she ordered up that to be a murder. And then the forgiving, the forgiving of Mark Rich. Oh, my God. And you know, Mark Rich. The pardon of Mark Rich. And you see, the pardon of Mark Rich is connected to the murder of Vince Foster because Mark Rich manipulated the hedge fund markets and took this money and gave it to Vince Foster. And then Vince Foster took it over here to Hillary and Hillary deposited in the Children's Defense Fund. Yet the entire Children's Defense Fund into this day is still Hillary Clinton's slush fund. They're not using it for what you think.
And somewhere in the mix of this story is Leo Wanta. I'll just throw that into the mix.
Yes, and Christopher Story was murdered, gangland style, by our black ops in the streets of London. And they cloned another one of him, and he's got a different name, and I don't remember, and he lives in Canada.
Right.
And that also exposes all these faction tours that we, you know, were hearing about connected with the Chris Story, Leo Wanta Mitterrand Fund, which again was a slush fund for, you know, the Nazi coalition of the 13 families, which is
right.
The entire story is still covered up. Yet it's all coming back. It's not going to go away. And there's a very short piece, it's about 12 minutes, and we thought we might play it. But this is, you know, everything's a spider web, but this other story has to do with Karl Rove.
Right.
And remember, he was one of a number of people, including Bush and Karl Rove and Dick Cheney and David Addington and what was the other guy's name? Anyway, they all conspired against a covert CIA undercover agent named Valerie Plame. And New York Times
Judith Miller
and Washington Times Bob Woodward, I can't remember which one it is, but they both helped in the outing of Valerie Plame. And what they put in the paper was the name of the corporation, Brewster & Jennings, which identified over 100 of the 300 covert status agents, CIA agents, that were working underneath Valerie, and they were instantly executed. So, and Karl Rove is very nervous about outing Don Siegelman and sticking him in a prison. And just lately, he got put in the solitary confinement, which is horrifying. You don't know what they're doing to him there. And with Karl Rove behind the scenes ordering it up, it's even more scary. And that solitary confinement is in Louisiana's most notorious, you know, federal jail in the whole country. And so we please need to wrap him in the violet flame. And Rama went to this place called Don. What is it called? The web's free-don.org, right?
Right.
And you all can go there. And there's also a place where you can you might say sign a petition to get him out. And there's all kinds of groups. There's justices. And
there's a GoFundMe page. GoFundMe.com/Don Siegelman Film.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Let's do what we can on those kinds of notes. But there is a film, and it's got a 12 minutes pre-screen here that we can listen to. And it will show everybody how scared Karl Rove is because of the story is going to expose him, and it's going to go public in all the theaters very soon. So let's listen to that. It's called Killing Atticus Finch, the Don Siegelman story. Here we go.
The guy who's sitting in prison is completely innocent.
In 2006, former Alabama Governor Don Siegelman was convicted of bribery. However, many of America's leading judicial experts, including prosecutors, judges, and lawmakers, now claim that he's completely innocent and the victim of a political conspiracy by his rivals.
I believe that his conviction and sentence represent a travesty of justice.
This is one of the most egregious miscarriages of justice that I've encountered.
Legal experts now accuse the federal officials in this case.
Okay, everybody, we're going to keep going. Go back to that piece, Rama. Okay, here we go.
People who orchestrated his prosecution include some of the most notorious names in politics.
Jack Abramoff. Every single time I ever saw him, one name came out of his mouth. Karl Rove, Karl Rove, Karl Rove.
A Republican lawyer from Alabama has apparently sworn under oath that Karl Rove pushed the Justice Department to bring political corruption charges against Mr. Siegelman.
Many of the events surrounding the Siegelman case have been covered by the New York Times, Harper's, CNN, and MSNBC. It was featured on the cover of Time magazine and the lead segment for 60 Minutes.
Is Don Siegelman in prison because he's a criminal or because he belonged to the wrong political party in Alabama?
Many Republicans have also come forward in his defense.
Why are there so many Republicans that are getting behind this Don Siegelman, who is a Democrat?
Don Siegelman was a victim because they could not beat him fairly. They beat him with corruption in the court system.
My case is extremely similar to Governor Siegelman. We both had rabid Republican prosecutors going after folks for political reasons, which is something we don't do in the United States of America.
Conservative writer and Pulitzer Prize winner George Will and John McCain's former chief of staff.
Grant Woods is the former Republican Attorney General of Arizona.
I haven't seen a case with this many red flags on it that pointed towards a real injustice being done.
I knew Don Siegelman, and he never would have taken a bribe. Don was incorruptible. But today, Don Siegelman is sitting in prison, and he's done nothing wrong. He was politically assassinated by these corrupt people who couldn't beat him any other way. It's like they were killing Atticus Finch.
Now, 113 former state's attorneys general, both Democrat and Republican, have signed a petition protesting Don Siegelman's malicious prosecution and seek to overturn his wrongful conviction. This is the first time in history that so many influential Americans have come forward to publicly denounce the deliberate injustice directed at one man. It all started just after winning his first term as governor.
The investigation into Governor Siegelman began 12 weeks after he took office. The Attorney General, Bill Pryor, subpoenaed Governor Siegelman's financial records.
Pryor's political advisor at the time was Karl Rove.
When people were still figuring out how to work the phone system in the governor's office, they were already investigating it. And it never stopped for the next 6 years.
After relentlessly investigating Governor Siegelman, his family, and staff throughout his entire first term, Pryor found nothing. Then, on his re-election night, like a page out of Bush v. Gore, CBS, NBC, and CNN all called the governor's race in favor of Siegelman. Mysteriously, in the middle of the night, a computer glitch shifted 6,000 votes from Governor Siegelman's column to his rival, Bob Riley. Siegelman supporters demanded a recount. However, Bill Pryor, the same attorney general investigating the governor, immediately threatened to arrest anyone if they were to initiate a recount.
Had the Republican district attorney in Baldwin County not threatened to put everybody in jail if they attempted to count those votes, we would have already had the votes hand-counted in Baldwin County.
As those votes remained sealed and uncounted, Bob Riley was declared the winner. Bill Pryor and Bob Riley, both Karl Rove clients, had won the day. There's much more about this event that remains undisclosed, and we want to reveal it in our documentary. Former Rove colleague and Republican whistleblower Jill Simpson would later testify before Congress that for years, Karl Rove had carried out a secret campaign to destroy Siegelman. More importantly, she also testified that longtime Rove colleague and Republican consultant Bill Canary once told her that his girls would take care of Siegelman. Then, just after announcing his candidacy for governor, one of Bill Canary's girls, federal prosecutor Alice Martin, indicted the former governor on fraud charges. Judge U.W. Clement presided over the case.
As it turned out, there was absolutely no basis to the charge. It was the most unfounded indictment that I saw in my nearly 30 years on the federal bench.
Not long after that case was thrown out, the former Democratic governor was indicted again, this time by the other one of Bill Canary's girls.
The U.S. attorney was Laura Canary, and on the day that she raised her hand to become U.S. attorney, at that moment, her husband was being paid by one of Governor Siegelman's announced opponents for governor and by the attorney general, Bill Pryor, who initiated the investigation in the first place.
Incredibly, Laura Canary, the prosecutor indicting him for bribery, was married to Bill Canary, the campaign manager of Don Siegelman's opponent. Then, even more surprising, the so-called bribe was simply a transparent donation to a lottery education fund with no personal benefit to then-Governor Siegelman.
It's the first time in American jurisprudence that this theory of bribery was used.
Governor Siegelman received no personal benefit whatsoever from that contribution.
After 8 months, Laura Canary claimed to have recused herself, although we can prove that's not true. Ostensibly, she handed the case over to her assistants, including Stephen Faga.
The United States tried as best it could to put the truth in front of them.
60 Minutes would later prove that Faga was not telling the truth. They found that Faga and the other prosecutors literally scripted the testimony of their key witness, Nick Bailey.
They made him write his proposed testimony over and over just to get his story straight.
Prosecutors then withheld important evidence that could have also exonerated the former governor.
Then his notes, by law, should have been turned over to the defense.
The CBS show explained how Bailey's story was logistically impossible to have occurred, and prosecutors knew it all along.
The check was cut days after that meeting. There was no way possible for Siegelman to have walked out of that meeting with a check in his hand.
That would seem like a problem with the prosecution's case.
We have prosecutors who should be in jail today.
Should the prosecutors be in jail? They brought trumped-up false charges to deprive somebody of their liberty. Yes, they should be in jail.
This time, to make sure trumped-up charges would stick in court, prosecutors went judge shopping. Enter Judge Mark Fuller.
You're not going to believe this, but somehow we end up with Mark Fuller as the judge in the Siegelman case. Years before, Governor Siegelman found that Mark Fuller had misappropriated retirement system money. This was all highly publicized, and while no charges were brought, it was very embarrassing. But now he's the judge in the Siegelman case, so he's got the perfect opportunity for payback.
Judge Fuller also had a very big secret to hide, one that still has not been fully disclosed. He owned a side business called Doss Aviation that previously listed its address at Fuller's courthouse chambers. In the middle of the trial, and unknown to Siegelman's defense, Doss Aviation was issued a government contract worth over $178 million. A contract that could have easily been influenced by the White House. As you might imagine, Judge Fuller's rulings and jury instructions overwhelmingly favored the prosecution and have been considered by judicial experts as completely unfair. If the name Mark Fuller sounds familiar,
That's because he's been mentioned in the media quite a lot these days.
What's your name?
Kelly Fuller.
Okay, she needs an ambulance. I'm sending a police. They're in a domestic fight now at the Ritz-Carlton.
That panic-stricken call to 911, wife of Judge Mark Fuller. After his arrest, Atlanta police stated that Fuller had dragged his wife by the hair, and as you can hear in the 911 call, she was beaten repeatedly. At this point, you may wonder why the appeals process hasn't stopped this madness. Well, remember Rove client and Alabama Attorney General Bill Pryor? After years of continuously investigating Don Siegelman, the Bush White House appointed him to none other than the U.S. 11th Circuit Court of Appeals, where Siegelman's case is being considered. As the former governor remains in prison, the all-Republican three-judge appeals court panel reviewing his case has delayed hearings over again without explanation. The next hearing date has been pushed to sometime beyond January 2015. Just after Republican whistleblower Jill Simpson came forward, her house was suspiciously burned down. On the day 60 Minutes aired the Siegelman story, the CBS affiliate in Huntsville, Alabama, WHNT, simply blacked the segment out. The story was not seen in northern Alabama during the regular Sunday 7 p.m. time slot.
This story has to be told because today, Don Siegelman is not only destroyed financially, personally, and politically, Don Siegelman is sitting in prison. He is in federal prison simply because a group of very corrupt and very powerful people wanted to get rid of him, and we can't let them get away with it.
In 2007, Karl Rove simply ignored his subpoena to testify before the House Judiciary Committee investigating the Siegelman case, stating that he was immune to a subpoena. He has refused to testify under oath. Rove was later questioned by George Stephanopoulos on ABC's This Week.
But to be clear, you did not contact the Justice Department about this case?
I'm going to simply say what I've said before, which is I found out about Don Siegelman's investigation and indictment by reading about it in the newspaper.
But that's not a denial.
Okay, that's the end. Turn it off, honey. The other thing I wanted to say is that there was like this it was a story on Al Jazeera about Hillary. And, this lately the personal emails were hacked by some young 20-year-old kids,
right,
Brennan, the head of the CIA, and when they got finished with the story, they said, you know who should really be head of the CIA? And they said, this one. And it was Hillary Clinton up there. And they are telling the truth without saying it. Hillary Clinton has had her fingers on the CIA since Bush Sr. Since then.
All in the family.
Yep. She was in partnership. She has been in partnership with Bush Sr. and Jr. since then. And it has never gone away. And this is why it's very important, everybody, that when you hear something being laid on President Obama, it's all Hillary. Every square inch of it. And her minions, meaning our CIA. And that is a very heavy thing to say, but that's how come she's getting away with all of this. And you know, these Republicans are getting away with whatever they're getting away with for the moment, just as a way to try to get her out of the running. And accountability is required. There is still so much ignorance about this, although I would say, and there's a lot of people saying this, is that the people have already figured it out, that the gig is really up. Yes, Rama.
I just wanted to say in this short moment, even though it looks like the worst of times, it is the best of times to be in a physical form in this dimensional reality.
Yes, it is. It's the best thing we could have done, even yeah. though it scares the heck out of everybody. Ranamu and Larry and Curly continued on. We didn't finish this part about it, but Ranamu said that Hillary doesn't have the 800 metric tons. We talked about that. Saint Germain has all the gold. But Hillary is being thrown under the bus for that. But by this whole dog and pony show, all the Clinton crime stories are coming out. And the market went up 300 points today, which is just more fakery. And at any given point now, the bread and circus show of the entire old Roman draconian empire is blasting through wide open to a swift. I don't know if there's some big noise there. At any given point now, the bread and where was I? Mr. Putin is using advanced off-planet technology given to him by the Andromedans. And there's a reason for this. The purpose is to shut the CIA out of Syria. It's also being used to shut out Netanyahu's Shin Bet and Mossad and special black op forces of the IDF in Syria. Also operating in Syria. There are ISIL, non-human, off-planet, super soldier operatives also going on in Syria yes. as well. All the moderate Syrian rebel groups are all operations of RCIA and are being removed by Putin.
Putin. Hi, Donald.
Whoops. Somebody said, hi, Donald. Oh, okay. Putin knows the rules of engagement very well, and Bashar al-Assad will be held accountable for his own crimes against his own people. At the appropriate time. So the orchestration has begun, and so has many, many more blessings coming our way. So I see we have our guest, and I pass this long-stem lavender rainbow rose talking stick back to you, Marita Robert. Marita?
Yes, I couldn't get the muted off. So welcome, Alex. We are happy to have you on our show this evening. She is an author and a teacher, speaker, and she's going to talk to us how to get from chaos to clarity, and that's her book. And I also want to acknowledge her for stepping in here at the last moment. I was planning to have her on, and our guest for tonight canceled, and so at the last moment today, she said, I can do it. So thank you, Alex. I appreciate that. So.
Thank you, and thank you so much for having me on. It's really a pleasure to be here.
So tell us a little bit about how, why did you write the book, and how did you get from chaos to clarity?
Thank you. Yes. And the book is called From Chaos to Clarity, Getting Unstuck and Creating a Life You Love. And the reason I wrote the book is because so many of us get stuck at some point in our lives. And I hear this all the time from my clients when I'm out talking with groups. So many people find themselves with these feelings of burnout, frustration, stress, anxiety about where their life is headed. And they just don't know how to change that. And I've also had those feelings. I've been in that stuck place. And so I wanted to write a book that addresses the issue head on and provides a roadmap for how you can get unstuck and take back control. So it helps empower people to essentially move from where their life is right now, which often feels like it's just headed completely in the wrong direction and they don't know how to stop it from going that way, and show them how they truly can create a life that they want.
So did you decide to do the book after you had already worked out this process for yourself? I'm assuming that this is or working with your clients. What was the instigator, I guess, of getting you to actually sit down and do a book? Because it's not a an overnight process. It's a commitment.
That's exactly right. It certainly is a commitment to sit down and write it. And I think it was a combination of two factors. Essentially, number one, I had been through this. I had been very stuck in my old life. I was a corporate professional for 15 years. And I just knew that something was missing. I just wasn't in the place I wanted to be. And I really finally, you know, stepped off the hamster wheel and decided to take a good look at where I was at and what I wanted to do. And as I went through that whole process and reexamined my life and got it back on track, I also then realized that I needed to share what I had learned with other people and help them navigate their life, because so many people have the same kind of experience that I had. And the book, essentially, as I started working with clients, as I came to coaching and speaking, I decided also that the book would be that roadmap. So, of course, when you're working with different clients, everybody has different issues and people go at different speeds. But I really wanted to take what I had learned and put it into a very accessible and concise roadmap that people could follow at their own speed. And you can read this book fast or slow, obviously, but there's also exercises in there to help people work through some of these issues. And I really wanted to put it all in one place so that it was a really accessible tool and resource.
So how long has it been since you finished that, and what kind of response are you getting for the book, and also for the seminars or workshops that you're doing? Are you finding
that?
Yeah,
thank you for
already?
Asking that. Yes, they are. And it's been really an interesting ride. The book is freshly out. It just came out on Amazon last week, so hot off the presses. But it's getting really wonderful reviews. And I've been hearing from folks that have been reading it saying, "Oh my goodness, thank you for doing this, for putting this together, because I knew that I needed to do something, but I didn't know where to start." And the big thing that I'm hearing is that it is, as I said earlier, it is a very accessible read. It's very sort of simply laid out. It's a step-by-step guide. And it includes all, you know, various different steps, you know, discovering how to look within for answers and connecting with your true self, as well as identifying and releasing and replacing some of those subconscious and very limiting beliefs that we can all have. And those really keep us stuck in place. And as you start to unravel that, then you can start to get really clear on what you do want and start moving towards that. And so I've really been getting some wonderful responses that people are ready. There's a lot of people out there feeling stuck or burned out or just totally frustrated with how life is going. And they have found this incredibly helpful.
Well, I'm looking forward to getting a copy and reading it, since this all happened so quickly. I do not have a book yet. And the interesting thing is, the transformational clearing that I do is helping people to, we talk about the stuckedness and getting rid of the old programs they've been running their life on that are no longer serving them. So I think we understand each other in the sense that, you know, how do we get out of this stuckedness?
Yes, absolutely. And yes, I mean, and I cover a lot of that in the book, because that really, those limiting beliefs, and of course you know all about this in your work, those really are the key to unlocking it all. And sometimes we just simply don't even know that we're walking around with them. I mean, I like to sort of talk about it in terms of using the analogy of a computer. You know, you use those desktop applications and we don't think much beyond that. But of course, underneath all of that is the operating system that makes everything work. And our subconscious beliefs, those limiting beliefs that we're carrying around, are like that operating program. So unless we become aware of them, unless we start to sort of dig underneath the surface and understand what they are, we don't know whether they're serving us well or not. Usually they're not. Usually they are limiting beliefs and they need to be released and then replaced with new beliefs, new guiding principles that we can really embrace and that can help us move forward.
Well, the other thing that we can announce here is that if people would like to call in and ask questions, we have an 888 number. So this would be 888-429-5471. That's free for the United States and Canada. And so if you would like to call in and ask Alex about a situation, if you feel like you're stuck, this might be an opportunity to do that. So 888-429-5471. So what if people want, when they want to do the book, I know they can go to Amazon, or if they want to read about your work, what is your website that we need to mention that as well?
Yeah, thank you. Yeah, the book is available on Amazon, and my website, I have two websites actually. One is alexbratty.com, alexbratty.com. And my book is featured there, but that's also my other work as well, my coaching. And I have a site that's dedicated to the book, and that's called, that's alexbrattybooks.com. So alexbrattybooks.com. And there's information there. You can access the book. You can also find out about my coaching. And, of course, it's available on Amazon.
Okay. So if is there anybody on our team here that would like to ask a question of Alex? I know, Kathy, you're on here, and Tara and Carolyn. Anybody else that would like to ask a question?
Well, I'll just say, this is Kathy, Alex, just saying congratulations. You got a book out. I mean, fresh for a week. You've probably been on cloud nine. It's a wonderful thing when you create something lovely like that.
It is. Thank you so much, Kathy. It's like giving birth almost. You know, I have fellow authors that talk about giving birth to their book, and I have to say, these last few months have sort of felt a little bit like that. So it does feel good to finally have the new arrival.
Yeah, baby's been born. Well, let's just ask you this question. You know, I'm sure that, you know, since everybody's situation is so unique to their lives, is there anything that you think is a theme that follows that you could share a piece, a little insight for any one of us that's at that place? That is there a little nugget of truth, a little jewel in there somewhere you'd like to share with the audience?
Yes, absolutely. In fact, there's kind of three things that I think are that are common across the board that people can use no matter what they're dealing with. So the first thing is hit the pause button, right? Because our lives are going in a certain direction. That's why we're stuck, because we can't stop them from going there, or they won't move at all. So just take a moment and step back from your situation, almost like you're a neutral observer of it, and assess the situation for what it is and accept it. Accepting it is the first part, right? Because we can't change it unless we accept it. And then the next thing is start identifying what you want in life. And I know that can sound very scary for a lot of people. A lot of people don't know what the heck they want. And I understand that. I get it. I used to be in that spot too. But here's the key to that. A great place to start is by looking at what you don't want people are often very, very clear about what they don't want, about what's bothering them in life. And so as you start with that, as you look at what you don't want, you can use that to get clear on what you do want. And that part is really important. Look at why you want these things and how you want to feel when you have them. And then the third thing that I always tell people is start paying attention to your thoughts and where you place your focus. Because what we say, what we think, what we feel, and what we believe inwardly, it all contributes to that outward reality that we create. And so realizing that you hold the power to create the life you want, and it's where you channel your energy and thoughts, that's also another key part of this, is to start focusing on those things you want and really start realizing that they can be possible. It's all about where you choose to put your energy and what you choose to think about. So those are sort of three key things that no matter where you're at, those are good places to start unraveling whatever's going on.
That sound like pearls of wisdom. Thank you for that.
So think more about what you want rather than focusing on all this stuff that's going on in your life that you don't want. And I think that's a really key thing for because people just get stuck because of the cycle they're in, or the term the rat race that they're running. You know, it's just this is what I've always been doing, and I just keep doing it, and I don't like it. But your idea of hitting pause, I think that's a very wise thing to teach people to do.
Yeah, thank you. Because, you know, as you said, if you're running the rat race, hey, if we're on a ship, we can't just turn the ship around. We gotta slow it down first, right? And make it go at a lot lower speed and then turn it around. Absolutely. And I think also, what you just said about, you know, what does keep us stuck and the focusing on what we want and what's positive, that's a really key piece to this, because it's really easy when your life is not going the way you want it, is just to focus on all of that stuff, right? All the stuff that's going wrong, all the stuff that you don't like. And the reality of that is the more you focus on that, the more you get of it. It becomes this downward spiral, and it can very easily spiral out of control. And I know it can be challenging when you're dealing with tough times to say, okay, wait, I'm going to focus on what's positive in my life. Maybe there's not as much of it, but it really is a key point. And looking for the things, being grateful for the things that you have, being grateful for who you are, for what you do have in your life, that's, you know, a critical element to all of this. And it helps you get into that positive frame of mind when you practice that gratitude, when you really evaluate your life and say, okay, I know there's a bunch of stuff that's not going great, but what do I have that I'm thankful for? What do I have that is actually going great? And what successes have I had in the past that I can point to, that I know that things can get better in the future?
Well, those are all really good thoughts, and one of the things that what I work with in the transformational clearing a lot is what we're really given is the years or the times in our life when similar patterns have happened, and many times people are not aware that, oh, the feeling I'm having, this distress or this discomfort or this nervousness or whatever the feeling is, once we identify it and they can be aware of when it started, then they can begin to even change it quicker because they realize the cause of the way they're feeling, why they're feeling the way they do.
Yes, absolutely. And of course, a lot of that gets programmed in at a really early age, right? It's it's what we see. It's what we observe as children. And, you know, of course, everybody loves to point their finger at their parents, right, when they have issues. And, you know, to some extent, there is truth to that, but not in the sense that we blame them. You know, as kids, that's what we do. We absorb what we're hearing and what we're seeing and what we're being told by our parents. That's just the natural order of things. And maybe they, you know, our parents did the best that they could with what they had. Maybe they have their own set of limiting beliefs that they brought into their parenting. And so the point there is, yeah, you may have gotten those things when you were younger from your parents, from other figures of authority, from siblings, whatever. But now you're an adult. And whatever those beliefs were, whatever we learned when we were really young, those don't have to be the things that we choose to believe and act on as we get older. And that is why it's so important to identify them, right? Because we're not always sure where these things came from or what they are. For example, I mean, so many people have this limiting belief that they're not good enough. They're not smart enough. And, you know, what is that? Of course we're good enough. We are good enough the way we are. And it's taking that pause and saying, wait, is that belief really true for me? You know, maybe I heard that from teachers, or maybe I heard it from my parents at some point that I didn't do something well enough, or I wasn't good enough at some particular activity. But that doesn't mean that that's true. It doesn't mean it's true about you as a person. And really kind of examining that, because as you said, if you can pinpoint where it came from, you can really then say, wait, is that actually my belief? No, not so much. It's someone else's that they gave to me a long time ago. And creating your own set of beliefs that you want to work off. And of course, it's challenging, right? Because we're adults and we may have been carrying these beliefs around for us for what, 20, 30, 40, sometimes 50 years. So it doesn't happen overnight that you just decide, okay, I'm going to believe this and everything's going to be rosy going forward. Of course, it takes time to make that adjustment because you've been carrying it with you for so long. But it can be done. And of course, you know in your work that you've seen the transformation happen when people are really able to go in and do that core inner work.
I just got a text from somebody that said they didn't have their pen in hand. They want the number given again. So if you wish to call in and ask a question, it is 888-429-5471. 888-429-5471. I think sometimes we read things pretty fast and if you don't have a pen and you're not ready, so it's good that they can text us and let us know what they need. So do you have classes or seminars or workshops or things that you do with groups as well as your counseling and consulting?
Yes, I do. Actually, I have some online and teleseminar programs that I put together. In fact, I'll have some new ones coming up towards the end of the year. And I love doing those online and over the phone because it allows people from all over, not just in my backyard, to connect with me. And of course, I do one-on-one work as well. I do that in person. I do that over the phone, over Skype, whatever is convenient. Because in this day and age, we don't need to limit ourselves to just serving our own community. That's important, of course, but I love the fact that I can reach beyond that. And of course, that was a big part of writing the book, right, is to reach a broader audience than just, you know, each person that I can coach. If I can reach more people and help more people, I want to do that and share these tools and these resources with them.
Well, this is, I think, very helpful just to remind people, like you say, we get in a rut or we are in a pattern and we've done this over and over because it's the way we've always done things. But if things aren't working, do hit the pause button and think about how could I do things differently? Tara, did I hear you say something? Or was that somebody else here in my ear? Okay, I'm listening on the phone and texting, and I had a phone call, so I'm multitasking here to try to get everybody on the same page with us here. What do you think is the most important thing for people to be aware of when they begin this process? I mean, first of all, they have to become aware that maybe they need to change, or they, you know, if they've just been so stuck, they've been doing it and doing it over and over, and yet if your life's not working, what do they need to do to get started?
Well, to get started, you know, I think the first thing is to be honest, right? To be honest about where they're at and what they really want to look at, because I can't help someone unless they're honest with me. So that's always the first thing that I talk to about clients. And then, as we've talked about, you know, hitting that pause button and evaluating the situation. But I think the key thing in terms of doing this work and getting unstuck is it is going to require change. Ooh, the dreaded word of change, right? Like we all are resistant to change. But you can't, if you want to get unstuck, you can't do that unless you have some kind of change, right? Otherwise, we're just living Einstein's definition of insanity, doing the same thing over and over and expecting different results. So I talk to my clients about change and about being open to that. And what's really interesting is the actual steps and processes to getting unstuck are actually very simple. What can be challenging, though, is working through them, right? Because it does mean reprogramming some of those deeply held beliefs. It does mean shifting our perspective on how we approach different people and situations. And most importantly, it means dealing with our innermost emotions. And that can be a little scary at the outset. Ooh, you know, I don't know if I want to go inside and look. I'm not sure what I'm going to find in there. But actually, once we do that, once we understand how to connect with ourselves and realize that we do have all the answers to the questions that we have swirling around, it starts to open up and people start to realize that they can move through this. And it is, you know, it's going to be a significant amount of change. But, you know, are you going to sort of wake up and realize you've been body snatched and replaced with an alien being? No, it's not that kind of thing. In fact, on the contrary, as you start to get unstuck, as you work through some of these processes that I have in the book and that I use in my coaching, you start to realize that you're experiencing more joy in your life. Things really do start to, like, the weight starts to lift off. And all those feelings of anxiety, of frustration, they start to drift away. And so will there be change? Yes. Is that a little scary at the outset? Yes, but that's why you're stuck right now, because you're not making changes, and that's what you're here for, to actually get unstuck. But will you and others around you benefit from that change as you work through it? Yes. And so it's really keeping your eye on the prize, as it were. You know, it does take a little effort and a little commitment to essentially work through these processes and stick with it. But coming out the other side, that's where the reward is, because you're going to feel empowerment. You're going to feel clarity. You're going to feel joy. You're going to have a new understanding of how you actually can create your own experiences and your own lives. And so it's keeping your eye on that prize of, okay, I see the path of where I'm going, and so I'm going to do this inner work to get there.
And so what are some of the, maybe it would be helpful to give people, what are some of the processes that that you talk about to get people out of that stuck in this place?
Yeah, thank you for asking that. Well, you know, there's a few steps to this. So the first one is to understand what's really keeping you stuck. And I know that might sound a little bit obvious, but actually what's keeping you stuck may not always be what it appears. It does require digging a little deeper under the surface. So that's one of the first things that we cover. Then it's to essentially reprogram your mind so you can change, as we've been talking about, those limiting and long-held beliefs about yourself and about others, right? This is about realizing that it's not what someone else did to you. It's not what others do or don't do or say. It's really about you. You're creating your own experience. And up until this point, you may not have realized that. You may have sort of been living a life by default. You're just kind of going along with what seems to be the right course or what you feel you should be doing. But you can become a deliberate creator. So it's getting in touch with that and realizing, okay, I have the control and I have the answers. And so another of the processes is understanding how to connect with yourself and get those answers, realize that you already have them inside you, and then how to actually access that. Then we look at releasing the past once and for all, right? We're so many of us are holding on to grudges and resentment and anger about various different things that have happened to us over the years. And so we talk about forgiveness. We talk about how to do that. And what it means to do that, to actually, you're actually releasing yourself when you're forgiving. It's not just about that other person. It's actually a really helpful thing for you to do it. Then moving on to embracing the present and the future, opening up yourself to all these other possibilities that up until now may not have even seemed, you know, possible at all. Because you've been so closed off and so kind of in the darkness and in this constricted place. But as you release that past, as you do that reprogramming, you do feel that lighter sense of things. You do start to move into this area where you feel the white space, as I like to call it, open up in your mind and your heart and realize there are so many other possibilities. And then we even move into essentially identifying what you really want, even your calling and your higher purpose, and looking at what is it that I'm called to do? What is the thing in my life that's going to give me the most fulfillment and the most meaning? Because again, that can be a reason that we're stuck, because we're just not finding fulfillment in what we're doing. We're not finding the meaning in our work or whatever's going on in our life. And so I actually, you know, guide you to a place where you're actually able to look at that and understand, oh, okay, so maybe these are the things that I want to focus on. Maybe I want to bring more of this into my life so that I have that fulfillment. And what does that mean that I need to release? So it really is a roadmap all the way from I'm totally stuck, I'm blaming things on other people, I just feel like I can't change any of this, to going through the processes and coming out the other side, being very clear on what you want in life and how to go get that, how to create it, and how to take the action. You know, that's a key point. I've been talking a lot about inner processes and inner work. But of course, there is another part of this. Nothing's going to actually happen unless you also take action. So it's about getting clear and setting your intentions inwardly first. But then once you have that clarity, once you know where you're going, then setting the goals, making the plan, and taking action so that you are actively moving yourself every day towards those goals, towards that life that you want to have.
I've just had a question text in. Is your book available on Kindle?
Yes, it is. It's available Kindle, paperback, and next week it should also be up in audio as well. But yes, it's absolutely available on Kindle right now.
Okay. And would you want to give, do you know what the prices are? That was a second question.
Sure. The paperback is $14.95, but I think on Amazon right now it's going for $11.96. I think Amazon has a little special going on there. And the Kindle, I believe, is at $3.99. Sometimes that gets adjusted downwards, though. So it's, I think it's a max of $3.99, but it may be even less than that, too.
I think it was less than that when I looked today.
But, yeah.
So, you know, like you say, they have things that change and shift, and so it's hard to keep up with
Yes. God bless Amazon. I love them. Of course, I love them because they're getting my book out into the world. But they do things just because they do things that we have no control over. So. So that's why I say, well, I think it's $3.99, but it could be cheaper than that. Go check it out and see what offers they've got going on.
Right. Let's see. Let me check this last email that just came in here. Okay. Okay, the question is how, if they wanted to talk with you, do you do phone consultations? Do you want to work with people that way or with Skype or whatever? And how would they connect with you? Or do they do that through your website or et cetera? Would you talk a little bit about your personal consultation time?
Yes, thank you. Absolutely. I do offer consultations. I usually do those over the phone. If someone wants Skype, I can, of course, do that as well. And you can contact me either via email or on my website. So if you go to alexbratty.com, alexbratty.com, there's a way to contact me there. Or you can just email me directly. And my email, very simple, alex, A-L-E-X, at alexbratty.com. Again, that's alexbratty.com. So alex at alexbratty.com. Yeah, and I welcome that. I'm happy to do consultations, and I love the question. I love that people are feeling that they want to reach out because it's my personal mission to unstick people. So if you are stuck, come talk to me. I will help you get unstuck.
In this day and age, not a lot of people are questioning this, but the one question they said, is there a way, if they don't have a computer, to still reach you? Or do you want to give that out? Or they can call me if you don't want to give your phone number out on the air.
Oh, no, I have an office line. It's on my website, so it's not a secret.
Okay.
my office line is 702-489-5124. That's 702-489-5124.
Okay, that's good, because most everybody has some time that they can do that, but there are some people that don't have it at home, and if they were wanting to do their counseling or connecting from home, they wanted to ask for the phone number. So thank you for sharing that.
Yes, absolutely. Good point. Happy to do that.
And what part of the country is that 702, Alex?
I'm in Las Vegas.
Oh, Las Vegas. Okay.
Yeah. It's cooling off a little bit finally now.
So that would be Pacific time?
Yes, exactly. Okay. I'm in the Pacific time zone. Okay. But I work with people all over the country. So as long as we just know which time zones we're in, so we're on the same page when setting up calls, it's no problem at all to work with people from wherever in the country.
Thank you, Kathy, for chiming in there. Did you have anything else you wanted to say? I didn't give you a chance to speak.
No. I mean, we've got some good questions and a strong sense. I think that, you know, we all are looking at our lives and saying, where am I stuck? I mean, through the process of evolution, it does it all by itself. And when you have someone that's written a book on it, it's a nice little check-in factor, I think. I like the idea of, you know, maybe seeing myself a little differently from reading the book, and maybe it would help me to just have another look-see, you know?
Well, and I know, Kathy, one of the things you mentioned after you had done the transformational clearing, you had the awareness, and I think this was, I'd never had anybody express it in the way that you did. And I think that sharing that of how when you had a feeling, you realized that that's where it came from, I think that's a good thing to share with people, if you would, because that's a very it's an intimate thing, and yet it's something that's so common. I think it would help people.
Yeah, well, you know, a lot of us have gone through things that we don't know why or how we came upon a particular attitude or a way of being, even down to our own central nervous system. We don't think of it as being something that happened because of an event. But when I did do that transformational clearing with you, I was very clearly shown through the process you put me through that there was an actual event that put me on edge and made me prone to a higher sensitivity, always having to do things right because of that time when I was young and my father was barking out orders, intimidating and frightening the heck out of me, you know, to, you know, do it right, do it straight. I was so young, and he was just a screamer, you know, and you become somewhat inside of yourself a little anxious to always make sure you do things properly and right, I guess maybe just to protect yourself. And you had put me through that process that allowed me to see in that moment when that occurred for me and how my nervous system has always been affected by it. And, of course, when you see something as clearly as that was shown to me, you can now look at it very differently and understand more clearly and make the shift, too. It allowed me to make that shift. It transformed the way I was seeing myself and doing things simply because of the awareness of where it came from. I somehow need to understand, and all of us, oftentimes we need to understand what makes things tick. And it was invaluable. And we've all had those aha moments.
The profound thing for me to hear you say was that today, when you have the experience of feeling anxious about something, you can say, oh, I know why I'm feeling that, and I don't need to do that anymore. I think that was a real a defining moment for me to have you understand that, because you talked about that on the show here one night.
Right. Indeed.
And so how do you feel when you have those moments, and what do you do about it then?
Well, I go into an immediate calm. It calms me to recognize, aha, okay, so here you are. It's showing up again. It's a trigger. You're late for something, and it makes you anxious because you won't get there on time. And so you go into this more highly elevated breathing and trying to get things done, and then you're more irritable, and then you just say, You recognize in yourself a pattern that you have been healing over a long period of time. And now that you even know where it came from, down to the events that triggered it, you can just settle back. And that's where I would say, Alex, that you say the pause. I have a pause. I push the pause button in that moment and will take a deep breath and say, hey, you're doing the best you can. This is what you have to work with. And you're still going to get there at the same time. So you may as well just take a deep breath, relax, be on time, be solid on your feet, be calm and sane, and enjoy the day without putting yourself into pressures that have no business being there.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think what you were talking about, Kathy, in terms of, you know, pinpointing when this happened, what that event was, and as you said, I want to understand it. It's so helpful to do that, right? So when we're doing coaching, and I'm sure Marita does this too, you know, it's not all about, you know, looking at the past and then kind of wallowing around in it. It's about looking to the past to understand, to pinpoint, as you said, that event, the specific thing that happened, the reason I have this belief or the reason that I have these trigger points. And then from there, you know, just acknowledge, okay, well, that happened in my past, that I've been carrying that around with me, but I don't need to stay there. And I don't need to, you know, belabor that whole thing. I can now understand it came from there, but it isn't me. It's whatever my dad said to me. It's whatever my mom did to me. And I can choose to change it. I can choose to change how I view this and not linger in the past and kind of be stuck in that sort of circular feeling of, oh, but they did this to me and I can never change. No,
yeah.
It's about pinpoint and then make that choice that, hey, that was them. That was them. They gave me that, but I don't have to hold on to it anymore because I understand it now.
And it becomes like a relief. You know, you have the right to stay calm. You have the right to be relaxed. You don't have to let an old trigger, all it's doing is just showing you that it's a deeply seated thing. It just needs to be seen, recognized, and honored. And we always say we praise, respect, thank, and love all our feelings. And I do that at the same time. I know where it came from. I can appreciate how I arrived to this place where I understand it now. And I can remain calm and not be triggered, to ruin a day, to make things difficult for myself and others. It just is no longer necessary.
Exactly. And you bring up a really great point about our feelings, about honoring them, because, so many people talk about, oh, but it's a bad feeling. I shouldn't be angry. It's bad to be angry, or I shouldn't be upset. No feeling is actually bad. In fact, all our feelings are essentially guiding us. They're information for us. It's like they're our internal GPS. So when we're feeling angry, or we're feeling fear, or we're feeling ashamed, or whatever that emotion is that doesn't feel pleasant, it doesn't feel comfortable, honor it for what it is and ask the question, okay, why am I feeling this way? What is this feeling telling me? Because there's a message here. It's not a bad thing to feel that way. In fact, it's helpful because it's enlightening me in some way that something's going on. Am I out of alignment with what this situation is, or with this person, or what's going on? What is it that this feeling is telling me? And as you said, to honor it. I think that's a really important point. I'm so glad that you brought that up.
Yeah, thank you. Well, that's what we do. It's really common for all of us to think in that way. We recognize that if we don't, we're on our paths, but if we don't do these things, if we don't fully honor ourselves, then we're always going to be holding these packets of information that try to take you down, when really it's just a process of moving through it,
Yeah. Exactly. And that's the thing, right? So the thought of moving through it, of sort of facing that fear, of looking at what that fear is, that is a scary thing. And that's why a lot of people don't do it. That's why they do get stuck. That's why they suppress those feelings. They push them down because they don't want to look at them. But actually, and you've been through this, so I'm sure you can kind of echo this probably, when you actually do look at what it is, when you actually sort of ask, what is the fear? Where is this coming from? What is going on here? It's never as bad as you think it's going to be. In fact, it's actually, it's a relief, because you're starting, as you said earlier, you're starting to understand it. Now I get it. I understand why I have this feeling. I understand why this particular trigger makes me feel that way. I don't have to do that anymore. I don't have to feel that way anymore. I can just move through it and acknowledge it.
Mm-hmm. Well, those are all good points. And I know that I'm surprised we don't have some callers, but sometimes the phone system doesn't always work either. So we'll see if someone does want to make a call here before we close. It's 888. 9-5-4-7-1.
And it's 844 here, so that's another 88.
Oh, okay.
This is Tara. Hi, Alex.
Hi, Tara. How are you?
Oh, well, I was just contemplating. I was a little bit indisposed when Marita thought I was asking for you, but I started to think about this, and I was just I was listening to Kathy, and I was looking back at some of the things I also overcame in my own past. And the next step after you're aware of that, and then you catch yourself, you might say, over time, I think is to completely clear any judgment you might have of your parents and why they did what they did and what was going on in their past, because that gets... that can completely clear it for all generations to come. At least that's been my experience, in other words, so that you can actually go back if you have kids, and you can clear it with them too. And then you can go back if your parents are still alive, and you can clear it with them too. In a way in which they might not even be fully aware of what you processed, yet it works. And these are all amazingly, exponentially freeing for us to be able to receive more love. That's my experience. I just wanted to share that. And I was also, Alex, you had this experience. I don't remember the whole thing, but you were sharing the last time that you didn't believe in God for a very, 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 very long time. And then somebody that you had, a client, there was this question. I don't remember what the answer was, but or what that was about. But you ended up intuitively going to a book on a shelf, and you.
No. This is. I know you're talking about someone else, Tara. This isn't Alex Braddy. That's our other guest.
Oh, I'm sorry. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
I got lost there. I thought, okay, did I miss something?
No, I knew where she was going. And what was the name of the guest we had last time? The naturopathic doctor. She was fabulous in her first experience at it was the one who.
Oops. We lost you, Kathy.
Sorry. You can get your angels involved. I mean, she did the angel book.
Oh, yes. Right.
Hiring the heavens. That's right. That's, you know what it is, Alex? Your energy is similar to hers. I think that's where Tara picked it up. And I kind of knew instinctively where she was going. And I was waiting for her to say something that would trigger my recognizing that she did that. So I knew exactly where she was.
No problem. I'll take it as a compliment that my energy is similar to a fellow author who wrote about angels. So I believe in angels. I believe they're guiding us and sending us messages in all different ways.
Yeah. And it is truly vibrational in that sense. Yes. Thank you for sharing what you do share. Forgive me.
No, not at all. And actually, Tara, I mean, just to acknowledge the point you were making about releasing judgment towards your parents. Yes, yeah, so important. And that part, that can be challenging. I mean, some people have had really, really difficult childhoods. And one way to look at that is to essentially, you know, look at what did my parents deal with when they were kids? What do I know about how they grew up? Because that can kind of help release some of that judgment, because oftentimes our parents did grow up with their parents instilling some of these limiting beliefs on them, right? And they had a tough time too. And then they basically arrive at being an adult and then becoming a parent, carrying all that around with them. So it's not that they're bad people, it's that they literally did the best they could with what they had. And so that sometimes is helpful to look at it that way, to release that judgment and to find that forgiveness with them.
And now the next question here that's just been sent to me is actually going to the other end of the spectrum. This person has just found out that they are pregnant, and they're asking if we have some suggestions that we might give them, even in utero, to begin working with this so that we don't develop negative patterning before the child is even here.
Oh, what a wonderful question. I love that. Yes, no better time to start than really, really young, right? One of the things that I would say there is something that I mentioned earlier, which is about what you focus on and what you think about and what you are sort of spending most of your time, even when you're talking or you're feeling or you're thinking, whatever it is, channel that in a way that's positive towards that child. So that if something, you know, if you're having a bad day, if things are going wrong, like I said earlier, it's really easy to get caught up in that feeling of, oh, everything is going wrong. Nothing is going right. And you just get into that downward spiral where vibrationally you're just like spiraling down and down and down. Look at the positive, focus on the positive, and bring this new life in with all those very deliberately directed thoughts. So I would really talk about, you know, talk to your child in utero, send it positive vibrations, send it positive thoughts, tell that you love it no matter what, him or her, that you love him or her no matter what, that they are good enough, that they're going to have a wonderful life. I mean, these are all things that you can start instilling at that very, very early age. And just because they can't hear, just because they're not a baby in this world yet, it's all about vibrations. I think Tara said that. Vibrationally, you can make a difference. And certainly she can do that as she's pregnant right now, as her baby is growing inside her.
And you can feel, the baby can feel this. In fact, in just in the last 2 weeks here, we've on our public television, we've had so much about the brain and about how the fetus develops and everything. And, of course, they've also talked quite a lot about playing music. And being a musician, I have had this belief system for a long time, but was suggesting that the classics like Mozart and Bach and are some of the better ones to use. It seems to be to give a comforting and leveling of the emotional field. Maybe it also helps the parent to have level emotions as well. So that may be transferred as well as just what the music's doing. So,
yeah, well, it's been
It's been a joy having you on. And Alex, let's give your the name of your book one more time and your website, and then we will say goodnight and invite you back another time.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure being here with you. And again, thank you for having me on the show. So my name is Alex Brady, and my book is From Chaos to Clarity, Getting Unstuck and Creating a Life You Love. It's available on Amazon. And my website is alexbratty.com, alexbratty.com.
Well, thank you so much. And a double thank you for filling in at the last moment here. It's we can always make up something and do have something for the show, but it just happened that the person that was supposed to be on was traveling and did not get back and knew that they were going to be flying tonight and could not be on the show with us. So we really appreciate you stepping up at the last moment today and filling in. So thank you very much, and we'll look forward to reading your book and having you back another time.
Thank you. It's my pleasure. And the angels were helping us out and guiding us. It was meant to be. So it was a pleasure to be here this evening.
Wonderful to have you.
Thank you.
So, BBS, let's take a musical break, and then we'll come back for the last segment of the show. Everyone, to the last segment of our Stargate Roundtable. Tara and Rama were in charge of this hour, and they always have wonderful information to share. So, Tara and Rama, I turn the talking stick over to you.
Okay. Hello, everybody. I think this is going to be a story from A to Z about the C blank A is what I think we're going to get a dose of, a whole pile of stuff here. Including, they've been talking about it on the air now, going back over the assassination of JFK. And that has to do with this new book this guy wrote. Rama, what's his name? Dave.
Well, and the other thing that I heard today.
Dave Talbot. Pardon?
The other thing that I heard today, and this was on the news, like public television news this evening, was how many that they'd had 22 hearings about all of this stuff with Hillary, and they've had 21 hearings about 9/11 and also about what happened in Iraq and Afghanistan and all of this other, how many hearings there have been and how much that each one of them cost and how many millions and billions of dollars that we've spent for some of these hearings, and they're rehashing the same thing over and over. But the important thing that, like you say, they're still, and they're bringing up more and more of the 9/11 stuff again. So,
yes, and it's gonna go all the way this time.
Mm-hmm. And well, we've been ready for a while, haven't we?
Yeah.
Oh, brother. Yeah. This Alan. This book this man wrote, David Talbot, author of The Devil's Chessboard, Alan Dulles, the CIA, and the Rise of America's Secret Government. And it's a good one. It's a really good one. And what I'd have to say about it is that Alan Dulles really did orchestrate this whole thing that we're watching, and he didn't do it by himself, though.
No.
So this is going to lead, and I'm just going to say again, put a circle of support around all of these participants, including the number one there. She looks like she really got bedraggled by the end of that Benghazi thing, but that they spent $5 million of U.S. tax dollars alone on that one, just on that one.
Yeah.
And this is the eighth time that this is being gone over. So, but the thing is that they didn't get to the story, did they?
No.
Not at all. And that's because Hillary Clinton has been in charge of the C-blank-A, along with Bush Sr., who's senile and has been for quite a long time. And Bush Jr., who is a basket case, and he likes to paint by himself.
You know, his toes.
And the stories are just so, and she's a clone. So, I mean, there's so many things to deal with. And the thing is that the people are not taking, you know, the back seat and just accepting all this stuff, even though they have gotten a lot out that pretends like that's going on. So remember, we got to go back to the Black Pope operation when we're talking about exposing murder of the Knight of Columbus,
yes,
President John Fitzgerald Kennedy. And guess who else is a Knight of Columbus but a white Knight of Columbus, and that's Patrick Fitzgerald, another good Irishman. Yeah. Who is cannot be fired, and a special prosecutor, and he's been ready now for some time. And the important thing is we must comprehend, it's very difficult to see these things when they come out all the way because they're so vile. I mean, they are so vile. We're going to play one piece tonight, and I want you to just completely take it into your heart and heal it from within yourself, because it's the amount of truth that comes out about just one thing, and this is Hillary's all the way too. This thing about immigration on our end. You know, we're listening to what's going on with the refugees, let's be honest. Today, into Slovenia, in one day, they got 13,000 mostly Syrian migrants, right. Refugees, and they are treating them abysmally.
Yes.
They have nothing, no blankets. They're out in the cold. They're throwing them pieces of bread, and whoever is tallest and strongest and bulliest gets the bread. And everybody else goes hungry, including, you know, women, children, people who are in wheelchairs, and they're sleeping on the ground, and it's almost freezing at night, and there's nothing to keep them warm, and it's against the rules to try to start a fire, so they get the police going in there and making them stop. This is awful. This is awful, awful, awful. And so without much ado, we'll go over much more of this
I want to play this one piece, and we have just a certain amount of time. So Rama's going to take this over there into the changing of the furniture position, and we're going to play this. And just, we love you, everybody. When we transmute these things together, it's a very important thing. Yeah. Okay. Tell them that it's coming.
It's coming along here.
These have been among... Sanders called for comprehensive immigration reform. This is Sanders addressing the National Association of Latino Elected and Appointed Officials conference in Las Vegas.
It's not acceptable to me, and I think a growing majority of the American people, that millions of folks in this country are working extremely hard, but they are living in the shadows, and that has got to end. Despite the essential role that undocumented workers play in our economy and in our daily lives, these workers are too often reviled by many for political gain and shunted into the shadows. Let me be very clear as to where I stand. It is time for this disgraceful situation to end.
Well, we turn now to a startling new report that examines America's broken immigration system called The Refugees at Our Door, just published in the New York Times by Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist Sonia Nazario. The article suggests the Obama administration is paying the Mexican government to keep people from reaching the U.S. border, people who often have legitimate asylum claims and, once deterred in their journey, often left to die. Nazario writes, quote, "In the past 15 months, at the request of President Obama, Mexico has carried out a ferocious crackdown on refugees fleeing violence in Central America. The United States has given Mexico tens of millions of dollars for the fiscal year that ended September 30th to stop these migrants from reaching the United States border to claim asylum. Essentially, the United States has outsourced a refugee problem to Mexico that is similar to the refugee crisis now roiling Europe." Well, for more, we go to Los Angeles, where we're joined by Sonia Nazario. She's the author of Enrique's Journey, the story of a boy's dangerous odyssey to reunite with his mother. Sonia Nazario, welcome back to Democracy Now! Explain what you found. How is the U.S. paying Mexico to stop migrants from coming north?
Well, we're doing the exact opposite of what Germany is doing. And, you know, I should say that I think we can have a debate about what should be done about economic migrants, people who come here for a better life. But with refugees, that is someone who is being persecuted and they are fleeing for their lives. And in Germany, we've seen these emotional images of the German people and Angela Merkel opening their doors, welcoming them at train stations. And what we are doing as a country is we have paid Mexico tens of millions of dollars to stop these refugees from arriving at our border and claiming, asking for refuge, asking for asylum. Our State Department is funding this, and our congressional leaders, the Department of State has said in a recent document that they want to spend $90 million next fiscal year in 2016 to do more of this. And what we're seeing is that this is paying for this incredible crackdown, where the immigration authorities have increased immensely the number of deportees. Mexico, in the first 7 months, deported 23,000 more Central Americans than the United States, and it plans to up that amount by 70% this year, while the rate is cut by the United States. So we're asking Mexico basically to do our dirty work. President Obama, for politically expedient reasons, 15 months ago, wanted this problem, as he saw it, of these immigrant children coming to the United States alone, this surge, to go away. And so he outsourced his problem to Mexico.
Can you tell us the story of Julie Elizabeth Perez, who you met in a migrant shelter in Mexico?
Yes, last month I spent 7 or 8 days in Mexico. I felt that not enough attention was being focused on this. And Julie, first, you know, she lives in one of the most deadly towns in Honduras, which the homicide rate has recently declined some, but per the last UN report, worldwide had the highest homicide rate in the world after Syria. And she lived in this very deadly town controlled largely by the 18th Street Gang, a gang that, by the way, started here in Los Angeles, where I live. And she, first, her brother was abducted and he was killed. They stole his $91 in rent money that he was taking to pay. They cut off his feet and his hands when they killed him. And then they abducted her 14-year-old son. They had asked him to join the gang. They start doing this to children at very young ages, 9, 10, 12 years old. He was 14. He had gone on a short errand a few steps away with a friend, been kidnapped, and she frantically searched for him and found him a few hours later. He had been suffocated to death with a bag over his head and found in a garbage bag. She fled to another city 3 hours away, and 7 months later, you know, the gangs are incredibly good at intelligence. They beat the CIA by a mile in figuring out who's coming in and out of towns and where the movement of people who are escaping gang violence. And she got a warning, we know where you are now. So 7 months later, she fled to Mexico, trying to reach her mother, grandmother, who were legally in the United States. She applied to the U.S. Embassy for a visa. They turned her down. And so her only choice to save her three remaining children was to try to get through Mexico to the United States. And it took her 20 days to travel 250 miles. These migrants are walking through Mexico now because they cannot get on the trains, on top of freight trains as they used to do because of this crackdown. And she encountered all sorts of obstacles, immigration officials shooting at her on top of the train with her children aboard, having to go around these enormous number of checkpoints, raids now, 20,000 raids on immigrants just in the past year as part of this Southern Border Plan, as it's called, that was pushed by President Obama.
Is it fair to say the U.S. is bankrolling these Mexican border guards who in a number of cases are guilty of horrendous human rights abuses?
Yes, it's absolutely true. We are bankrolling this. Tens of millions of dollars last year. And as I said, $90 million proposed by the Department of State this year. And that doesn't count what the Department of Defense has been kicking in, an unknown amount. And many, many studies have shown that Mexican officials, both the federal police, the state police, and immigration officials are complicit in this robbery, rape, killing of immigrants as they try to travel north to the United States to safety. And we see children now walking the length of Mexico, trying to elude those officials, and women like Julie putting their children, her three-year-old, her six-year-old walking for days on end, for 12 hours at a time, putting her three-year-old on her shoulders, trying to get her north through Mexico to the United States to safety. I think what we are doing is shameful. Refugees are people fleeing harm, and we should at least give them a chance of proving that they are refugees. And if they aren't, then perhaps send them back. But we have signed protocols saying that we will protect refugees. We have urged other countries like Germany and the countries surrounding Syria who have taken in more than 4 million refugees. We get a few tens of thousands, and instead of trying to comprehend what they're going through and welcome them or at least put them through our judicial system and see if they qualify or not, we have paid Mexico to send them back to their deaths. There is a study by our social researcher that just came out showing that in the last 21 months, 90 people at least have been murdered shortly after being returned by the United States and Mexico to their home countries in these three very violent countries in Central America, including a 14-year-old boy returned to Honduras, Gredis. Within 24 hours of being returned home, he had two bullets in his head. This is what our policies are causing, and I think the American people need to say, this must stop. I do not want this done in my name. I do not want my taxpayer money funding this. And I have a letter on my website, EnriquesJourney.com, if you agree to send your congressional leader saying that you want a fairer policy towards refugee children in particular.
Last year, Democracy Now! Spoke to Jose Luis Zelaya. He fled his home in Honduras at the age of 13 in search of his mother. He traveled unaccompanied through Central America, finally reached Houston 4 months later. Zelaya described his journey.
Honduras is a very dangerous country. Once I was simply playing soccer and there was a drive-by shooting. And during the soccer game, I ended up being shot twice in both of my arms. And it was then when I made the decision that I needed to run away. I needed to leave Honduras and come to the United States to find my mother. I didn't know where she was. All I knew was the area code 713, which was the Houston area code. And I came to the United States. It took me 45 days to come. It was horrible. It is the worst experience that I have ever witnessed, to be thirsty and not have water, to be hungry and not have food, not even a trash can to be able to find food was available in the desert. Whenever you're riding the train and you see people lose their lives, you see little girls being physically abused by the coyotes, and you can't do anything because you're a child. I was 13 years old when I came. I wasn't trying to break the law. I was trying to fulfill the law by trying to reunite with my mother, by trying to reunite with my sister. And when I came to the United States, I was actually in a detention center as well in Harlingen, Texas. And the experience there were very difficult. We were only allowed to see the sunlight 1 hour a week, and we were only allowed to drink water 3 times a day.
That's Jose Luis Zelaya, who fled his home in Honduras at the age of 13. You yourself rode on top of 7 freight trains, the length of Mexico, with child migrants a decade ago. How does what they go through today compare, Sonia Nazario?
Well, I think, you know, it was certainly difficult back then. I still have post-traumatic stress to indicate how hard it was. And as Luis mentioned, it was very difficult. Many people are robbed, raped, beaten back then. But we've seen just in the last year an 81% increase in robberies. And you're seeing by the time people got to the shelter, the migrant shelter, which really has become a refugee camp, by the way, just 200-300 miles inside the southern border of Mexico, 95% now are robbed by the time they get there, some of them multiple times. The majority of the women are being raped. And so what you're seeing is an exponential increase in the harm being done to these migrants, both by the immigration authorities and by this whole army of delinquents that have taken the message from the Mexican authorities. It's open season on migrants. You can do whatever you want, because we need to get at the U.S. Bidding. We need to get this flow to stop, to get these people not to reach the United States border. And so what we're seeing is, instead of riding on top of that train, on top of the freight trains up the length of Mexico, as I did for my book Enrique's Journey, people are going in places that are harder, that they are more isolated. And that's where these delinquents have all risen up, that are robbing and raping and killing in extraordinary numbers. 20,000 Central Americans are being disappeared every single year, kidnapped. And many of these people resurface after someone in the United States has to pay ransom to release them. But if you can't pay, they will kill you. They will cut you up in front of the others as a message. Many of them are being enslaved to work in marijuana fields or digging tunnels, prostituted. They are finding people. 14 migrants recently awoke drugged up with slits on the side of their bodies, wounds that had been sewn up. Their kidneys had been harvested. It's another level and a higher number of robberies, rapes, killings that are happening today than when Luis made the journey and when I made the journey. And yeah, you had to convince me that this was a lot tougher than before, but it is tougher than before. It is extraordinarily hard. And that's why people are stopping 200 to 300 miles in at the shelter that I was at and saying, I can't go back. They will kill me in my country, but I can't go forward. They will kill me in Mexico. I'm going to try to get asylum. I'm going to try to get a humanitarian visa from Mexico, which, by the way, Mexico makes extraordinarily difficult to get. They try to put every barrier possible to apply for asylum. If you're detained, they basically don't inform you of your right to asylum, which they are supposed to do Per Mexican law, only 1 in 10 people are being informed. If you're informed, they try to dissuade you from applying. And if you're even able to apply, which only 2,000 folks were able to do last year, they hold you in these jails that have rats roaming by day, worms in the food. They try to do everything possible to discourage you. And only 20%, you stay there months or even a year if you appeal, only 20% of people who are able to apply win their asylum claims versus 50% in the United States. So Mexico is putting every potential obstacle they can in the course of people trying to reach our borders and say, help me. They are trying to kill me in my country. I cannot go back, and now I cannot move forward. I am stuck.
Sonia, the man we just heard from, the young man who moved who traveled here when he was 13, Jose Luis Elias, with the group United We Dream. And that's the same group that protested Hillary Clinton. We just played a clip of her speaking in Las Vegas. She was actually heckled there by United We Dream. And one of the protesters, Juan Carlos Ramos, issued a statement saying, our message to Hillary Clinton is simple. Immigrant youth do not trust you. They were protesting the fact that private prison corporations donate to Clinton's campaign, and they said she should reject that money. What about the prisons here in the United States?
Well, we've managed to get a law passed in Congress that 34,000 deportable immigrants will be locked up any night in our prison system, as we've locked up fewer nonviolent drug offenders. We have, the prison industry has found a way to fill those jails with immigrants, and that's absolutely true. It's gone from 800 million or so 7-8 years ago that they made off of immigrants to more than $2 billion. This is a huge industry for them, and they spend a lot of money at this, and we can get laws like that passed through our Congress, but when we try to get a law allocating $50 million to immigrant children so a four-year-old doesn't stand before our immigration judges being asked to present their asylum claim all by themselves, we don't allocate immigration lawyers to immigrant children who come here alone, and so you see these children shaking with utter fear before that judge. Well, that law got shot down by the Senate, so it's absolutely true that the prison industry wants to keep this going, and companies like Correction Corp of America and GEO have made a lot of money off of this. I think instead of what we are doing, we need to push our government to do what Germany is doing, which is to establish a system, be a leader in terms of refugees, and establish a system to allow these refugees to arrive at our border and claim asylum, and then redistribute these migrants to Canada, to Latin America, and yes, some to the United States, so that they are safe while we address the root causes of this violence, help these countries address the root causes in Latin America. You know, we only take in 70,000 refugees a year. Germany, that dinky country in Europe, will take in more than 10 times that number this year. I think we can afford to go up to at least 130,000. That's what we took in pre-9/11. To allow especially these children to have a safe harbor in this country. And instead of paying Mexico to turn them away, we should also pay them to make sure that they for asylum. Mexico only has 20 asylum officers in the whole country, 3 offices. They have purposely underfunded this.
You choose to use the word migrant and refugee rather than immigrant. Why, Sonia?
Well, I think with a refugee, it is a person who is being persecuted in their home country, and they are fleeing harm. And this is what I saw when I went to Honduras 14 months ago. I saw children. You know, we have we spend billions of dollars to stop the flow of drugs coming from Venezuela and Colombia up the Caribbean corridor to the Dominican Republic, Jamaica, Haiti. They were landing there, those drug flights. We spent all this taxpayer money. And what did the narcos do? They simply rerouted, and they're now landing 4 of 5 narco flights in Honduras. And so they are trying to control that turf to move drugs north to us, the largest consumer of illegal drugs on earth. We use 1 in 4 illegal drugs on earth. And they are recruiting children to control that turf, to serve as lookouts, to sell drugs in those neighborhoods, and to work as sicarios, to kill people ultimately. And I saw children as young as 11. I spoke to an 11-year-old boy in a piece I did 14 months ago in the New York Times. He said, I'm 11 years old, I'm in the sixth grade, and these radicals are telling me as I come out of my elementary school, which they control, you are going to start using crack. And if you don't and get hooked on crack and start working for us, we are going to kill you. And so your options for a lot of these children are start working for the gangs, start working for the radicals that the gangs often report to, or flee. Those are the options. And what we're seeing is the kids coming through Mexico are younger and younger, half that are caught in Mexico, 11 and younger, and more of them are girls. The girls I saw in that neighborhood, they were 40% now of the girls, of the children caught in Mexico now are girls. They are being told, you will be my girlfriend by the gang leader, the narco leader, or I'm going to kill you, I'm going to exterminate your whole family. And so I'm seeing many more girls and women coming through Mexico. At the shelter I was at, there was a 28-year-old woman. She had been kidnapped by the gang, the 18th Street gang in her neighborhood. That's basically the law in her neighborhood. There is no government to turn to in certain parts of Honduras. And she came out of her job. They grabbed her, four gangsters, took her to a house, and there was a man tied up there, and they forced her to watch it as they beat this man to death, stabbed him in his arms and legs, and then cut him up in pieces. She doesn't know if he was alive or dead when that happened. And then forced her to hold the garbage bag as they put his pieces into it and told her, you're going to be my girlfriend tomorrow, or this is what will happen to you tomorrow. She fled without even saying goodbye to her four children, without giving them a hug because she thought they would have questions and that might put them in greater danger. She fled to Mexico, where she is now at that shelter, trying to get through Mexico and trying to reach safety in the United States. This is what people are fleeing. And this is very different from someone who is an immigrant coming here for a better life, like my parents came here from Argentina. They wanted a better life for themselves, but they were not fleeing for their lives.
Well, I want to thank you very much, Sonia Nazario. Your piece is just astounding in the New York Times. We will link to it, called The Refugees at Our Door. Sonia Nazario, Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist, author of Enrique's Journey, the story of a boy's dangerous odyssey to reunite with his mother. We will also link to our own Democracy Now!'s Renee Feltz's award-winning reports on the private immigrant detention centers run by for-profit corporations on the border of the United States at democracynow.org. When we come back.
Okay, everybody. That was a whirlwind. Yet the realities, in order to change, we must know what's there to change. So thank you, everybody, and the power of us putting this together in our hearts for transformation can make the difference. Okay, now we're going to take a little time and do something a little bit lighter. And this is our brother Nassim Haramein. We're going to continue from where we left off. And we have a little bit of time for him tonight. So, all right, here we go.
The red one on the edge, an hexagon on the edge. Four hexagons intersecting, creating equilibrium at the center of singularity. And note that there is 12 vectors radiating from the vector equilibrium. So there's 12 vectors radiating from the center, and there's 12 edge vectors, 24 vectors. These numbers are found in most ancient civilization texts. 12, 24, and so on are found everywhere. The 12 angels with singularity in the middle, the 12 apostles with Emmanuel in the middle, the singularity, and so on. the 24 elders in Kabbalistic tradition, and so on. So I was really amazed that I had found this, but my geometry was still out of equilibrium. Meaning, on this geometry of the two isotropic vector matrix, the vector equilibrium in the middle had all of its octahedrons filled. That means that when the vector equilibrium is in the middle, the pyramidal structures are completed with octahedrons. But the edge octahedrons were incomplete, so I still had a symmetry. So I went back to the drawing board, back in my van, trying to, you know, I've got this in my brain, and I'm noticing that some of the faces of the octahedrons are not covered. So it's asymmetric. So I decided I have to keep adding tetrahedron till I gain symmetry. So I kept on adding tetrahedron, and to cover all of the faces, I had to add 24 tetrahedrons to the ones that were already there. So this is one isotropic vector matrix is 20. The other one is 20, that's 40, plus 24. 40 plus 24 was 64 tetrahedron matrix. The 64 tetrahedron metric is a match to many, many things. I'm going to give you a hint. There is 64 codons that generate the 20 amino acids of your DNA structure. Okay? Now, when I found the 64 tetrahedron grid, then I realized that that was the quanta in which symmetry was present everywhere and equilibrium was truly generated at the center. But what got me really excited is that I realized what I had built. What I had built was a fractal structure. Just like the 2D fractal structure I showed you at the beginning, but this one in full 3D spherical coordinates. The only true fractal 3D spherical coordinate that you will find. Can everybody see the vector equilibrium on the inside and then the vector equilibrium on the outside? This continues to grow to infinity. And I could see that the inside vector equilibrium, its radius is exactly half the radius of the one on the outside. So the geometry grows in fractals, but not only does it grow in fractals, the fractals are perfect octaves. You see? And so I got really excited. It's like, oh my God, here it is. The structure of the vacuum. Equilibrium to infinity. Infinitely big to infinitely small. And then I noticed further that how this was constructed is constructed this way. Let me see if I can let go of some of this stuff. Actually, I'm going to need that. I realized what I had built. I had built a matrix based on 8 star tetrahedron, each having 8 tetrahedron in it. Okay? All coming together towards the center to generate the star, the 64 tetrahedron grid. But when it did, the 8 stars coming together, okay, here you're only going to see 6, plus the one in front, And then there's one in the back you won't see. So the eight stars coming together generate the vector equilibrium in the middle. Why is this significant? Eight-star tetrahedron is made out of eight tetrahedron pointing upward, radiation, coming together to generate the vector equilibrium, which is eight tetrahedron coming towards the center, generating contraction. So now, not only did I have found the geometry of equilibrium, but I had found the only fractal 3D metric, and it generated expansion and contraction. Exactly all the axioms I had placed for myself when I started this investigation of the geometry of space. I was so excited. I'm still excited. I was doing this in my brain. I didn't have a computer, and I confirmed it later on computers. But I was like, oh my God, this is so awesome. And then something really weird happened. I knew I had the fundamental structure of space. I knew, you know, I was definitely seeing. Now realize, you guys, if we truly have the fundamental structure of creation, then technology that's based on this information is going to tap directly into an infinite potential of energy, infinite potential of gravity, infinite potential of rejuvenation, regeneration, and so on. You're talking serious change in our way of doing technology. So I was really excited. And then a bunch of people in England called croppies. Those are people that measure and photograph crop circles. Okay? Now, I know you guys, crop circles, There's scientific papers that were just published in peer-reviewed journals about crop circles, you know, because many of them are not being able to be explained by people going in the fields at night and stomping around, you know, Doug and Dave drinking moonshine and freaking everybody out. Some of them are not easily explained, and actually papers have just been published in peer-reviewed journals saying that this might be a new source of energy. But the croppies that I'm talking about decided in 1997 that if somebody was trying to talk to us through the crop circle, maybe we should talk back. So they went in the crop circles and they wrote in big letters by stomping around with their boots, "What do we need to know?" Good question. And the next crop circle that occurred was the largest crop circle to date at that time. And this one. Have we seen this somewhere? This is everything we've been talking about this morning. What do we need to know? Well, that's really nice. They give us this. They even made it in a way that's not reproducible by Doug and Dave drinking moonshine. Because all the hay is woven in a way that you can, it makes effects of light and shadow that gives the vertices, the edges of 3D tetrahedrons. That is not easily done in the middle of the night. And so And it was enormous. It was the largest to date. It was much larger than anything previous to that. And it was interestingly situated near ancient, you know, sacred site. And then a few weeks later, the next crop circle, a few weeks later, was another iteration of the same thing. So they were insisting on the pattern. What do we need to know? You guys get it? Look at tetrahedral fractal geometry. Right? How do you fit infinity in a finite space? Note that on these fractal curves, although there's not a boundary around the whole thing, the boundary is implied because the circles are all there of the smaller boundaries of the fractal. You guys follow this? So I was like, oh my God. Well, you know, when I found this, I was living at my friend Gabrielle Cousin, you know, in Arizona, and, you know, he found me jumping on his couch, pulling my hair out. I got a picture of that part in the middle, and I realized what it was. It's the exact same geometry, but this one going inwards, towards infinitely small. So I was, oh my God, this is actually telling us everything we need to know about the structure of reality, the structure, the physics of creation. And that's according to my theory. I was mind blown. But then I, on top of it, they made it so nice that you could actually overlay the 14 octahedron cavities that are generated by the 64 tetrahedron grid right on top of it. And you get a very nice match. So, you know, and then since then, it's been going berserk. There's been 64 tetrahedron crop circles occurring. Look at the precision. Again, right beside an ancient site. Stone site with an enormous stone that was placed on top of another. And sure enough, when you overlay the 64 tetrahedron grid, you get a perfect match. This is not trivial. Okay? When you continue to explore the crop circles, this one is really interesting. It was thought to be, by one of the famous psychics, the most important crop circle ever to occur. And because it's really simple, everybody went, huh? There's other crop circle much more interesting. But in fact, if you look carefully, that crop circle is a 2D representation of a 3D vector equilibrium. And in this crop circle, it gives you singularity in the middle, and it tells you that each tetrahedron generates the sphere, the radiative side of the equation. And if you take that sphere around each tetrahedron and you add the other ones of the other tetrahedrons, you get this symbol, the seed of life, known as the seed of life or popularized as the seed of life. That is a symbol that is found in many, many ancient civilization walls as well. And then they give you a crop circle to tell you you've decoded it right. And they insist. Here is your intersecting spheres. Note torque, rotation. Do you realize that current Einstein field equation does not accommodate for torque? What they did is that they eliminated torque by attaching the observer to the rotating object. So that they wouldn't have to deal with Coriolis effect and torque. Well, if you do that, there's a good chance you're going to end up with 98% of the mass of the universe missing. Which is exactly what occurs in current cosmology. But instead of revising their approach to energy and torque and so on, they invented a new kind of matter. They call it dark matter. And they just plugged it in to the equation to make it work. Some kind of dark matter that doesn't radiate, that nobody can detect. It's convenient. Your equations are missing 98% of what of the mass out there, and instead of revising your equations, you just plug in some dark matter. This is not what I think of good physics. But if you look at galaxies and so on, imagine all the torque you would need to orbit a galaxy, billions of stars. You're talking about a lot of energy. So they give us a little bit of an idea about the rotation here and the Coriolis effect. But as well, you know, in case we were confused, they made sure we realized that it's all in a fractal structure. You see, it's all there. Just amazing. Okay, this is a part of the presentation. Are you guys all doing okay? I'm just going to finish this section, and then we'll go... How are we doing? 12:30. Actually, do you guys want to take a little break and go to the washroom and all this? We'll do 10 minutes. Or actually, let's do 5 minutes. Be back here at 12:35, okay? And we'll reconvene and we'll do another section and then do lunch. This next section is really exciting. It's a lot of fun. Okay. Have a good break. Thank you. Well, we're going to go a little longer and do this section. This section is quite amazing. And you might not get right away the relationship to this research, but you will get it in this afternoon session. So we were talking about crop circles. And... you know, all these, you know, esoteric crop circles that are occurring. And if you don't have a base in what we've discussed earlier, it doesn't necessarily make sense. It's like, oh, wow, you know, a bunch of really cool geometries in the field, you see. But with what we have come to in our conclusion, with what the logic we've been following since this morning, then all of a sudden these crop circles have a whole new meaning. They are talking about something very, very important, very fundamental to reality. And, you know, you imagine that you were an advanced species that had the capacity to travel across the universe. And you showed up on this planet, you know. You found this planet and, You know, you're basically like studying the planet a little bit before you land, you know. And, you know, you kind of tap in the radio waves and the TV. And, you know, you look at the TV and you watch a football game with, you know, all these people bumping into each other, running after this piece of skin. And, you know, all the rest of the people, thousands of people getting drunk, eating hot dogs, you know, and doing the wave, you might find that when you turn around and you say, okay, who's volunteering to go on the surface, you'd have a hard time finding volunteers. You know? You might find, and I don't have anything against football, but, you know, it's all the people shooting at each other. You'd probably say, well, you know, it's not a good idea to land on this planet right away. We got to wait till these people have a little bit more understanding of the way the universe functions and how it works together and how the universe actually works in collaboration with all points, not in destructive and with all points. And so, you know, there's lots to be said about that. The concept that the universe always goes towards further disorder is violated by simple observation. The laws of entropy are violated by simple observation. And I'm gonna go through that a little bit more this afternoon. So remind me, but, you know, we don't have time to go through that right now. But basically, there's evidence, including your own existence. If you take your DNA and you put it end to end, well, you'll find, first of all, that in one cell, there is 6 feet of DNA. This is from the Genome Project. And if you took the 6 feet of DNA that's in one cell and then put all the other 6 feet of all the other cells in your human body right now, you could wrap your DNA 5 million times around the world. That's how much DNA there is in you right now for you to exist. That is not a sign of disorder. That is a sign of extreme amount of order, extreme amount of organization and complexity. So maybe, you know, if you were one of those species that found one of these planets that hasn't figured out the organization and the complexity and the support that the universe generates in order for you to be there, you'd probably try to give them a bunch of drawings in their crops and stuff, try to educate those people before you try landing on the White House lawn, right? Because you probably won't find no volunteers to go and get shot, right? But did they only talk to us about the geometry of the vacuum, the geometry of reality? No, they didn't. They actually talked to us directly in binary code. We have been contacted. Two summers ago, this crop circle occurred. It's the only crop circle that ever made it to the mainstream media news all around the world. I had friends calling me from the eastern U.S. telling me, I just saw a crop circle on the 5 o'clock news. The reason why this crop circle made it to the 5 o'clock news around the world is because it occurred in the middle of a rainstorm. It rained all night. Cats and dogs. And in the morning, this crop circle was there in this field, the largest crop circle ever to occur, 409 circles. It's enormous. And basically, it told the world crop circles are not just hoax. There is crop circles that are not hoaxes. Well, the next crop circle about after this one did not make the mainstream news around the world, most likely because it was too shocking. The next crop circle that occurred was a reply to this. In 1972, Carl Sagan and other physicists, astrophysicists, figured that we had just finished building the Arecibo radio telescope, the largest radio telescope on Earth, and we had the opportunity to send a very strong signal into the universe that could reach a faraway planet one day. And maybe they would decode the signal and then send the signal back, and then it would reach our planet one day. And we would know that there's living entities out there. But that would take a few thousand years. They still decided to send a signal to give a chance to our grandchildren to get, you know, a chance to have a talk with other beings out there. So they figured out a way to send a signal that would be the easiest for others to decode. They use a binary code of ones and zeros, just like a computer, and that can be transferred to a punch card, just like a computer punch card. Okay? And what does it say? It says, we're made out of carbon. This is our chart of elements. This is our DNA. We have a small head, big body. We live on the third planet from our sun. And you see, that's the sun. That's the third planet we live on. And this is the Arecibo radio telescope we're sending this way. This is the technology we're sending this way, a radio telescope. So they sent it in 1972. And 2 summers ago, across a radio telescope commonly hired by SETI to listen for a reply, came 2 crop circles, one being a reply to the Arecibo radio telescope signal, and the other one being a nice little mugshot. Did you hear about that crop circle? No. When SETI was asked about this, you know, SETI is the NASA, you know, search for extraterrestrial life. You know, they're listening with huge radio telescope to see if they can hear something out there that would be life on another planet. One day I'm going to make a comic strip with a huge radio telescope, a SETI guy with the big earmuffs, you know, listening, and in the background, back here, a little UFO. when they saw this, they said, well, it's got to be a hoax. Because if they wanted to talk to us, they wouldn't have sent a crop circle. The radio telescope was right beside it. Why didn't they just send a radio signal? Well, my reply to that is, if they would have sent a radio signal, you and I would never have heard about it. Maybe they wanted to talk to all of the people of the planet, not just a few agencies, right? So instead, they sent instead of a radio signal, they put the crop circles reply directly across from the radio telescope. And you're going to realize that here you have a governmental installation that has infrared cameras, guards, and all of this. Nobody saw nothing. Right? And it's not like Doug and Dave can go in that field and do that all night and nobody noticed. And then when you look closely, the woven pattern of the hay are not reproducible readily in the middle of the night stomping around. The actual mugshot is an incredible pattern that generates a negative image of a picture. And you can tell that that being has large eyes, a small nose, a small mouth. And the reply says, this is what we sent, this is what came back. It says, we are carbon and silica. Our table of elements is very similar. It says, we have a three-strand DNA structure. It says we have a big head and a small body. We live on three of the planets of our solar system. The third one has four moons. And this is the technology we're sending this way. Now, this is not subject to interpretation. This is a binary code. They're talking to us directly. Okay? Now, when I saw this, I got really excited because I'm like, oh my God, they give us a blueprint of their technology. Mm-hmm. It's right there on the bottom. I'm like, whoa, what is this? Well, the resolution is really poor, so you can't tell what the heck it is. Well, they thought about that. They were nice about that. Because a year prior to this reply to the Arecibo message, in the exact same field, a year to the date of the reply, prior to the reply, to the date, this crop circle occurred, which is exactly what's at the bottom of the reply. Just to make sure we had a high resolution blueprint of how they're using their technology. Here's your radio telescope. It's the exact same installation. You can see here the fans, you know, and all the security equipment. And this is right across from it. And that's what it looks like. Fractal tetrahedron geometry spheres. Everything we've been discussing this morning. So here, they're telling us directly, and notice, you know, that the sphere are fractalizing to smaller and smaller outside, and fractalizing towards singularity on the inside. Now, that's just incredible. And that's not the only thing they've been contacting us with. A year after the Arecibo message reply to the date. So this was a year prior, right? So the Arecibo message came in. At the bottom of the Arecibo message, there was a technology which they had put a year prior, right? Now we're going to go a year after. So last summer, midsummer, a crop circle occurred exactly the same day, but a year later. And this one was an enormous crop circle. Almost 2 football fields long. again, across a large installation communication antenna, which has security all around it, right across road. This is a huge crop circle. Can everybody see what it is? It's the side view of an alien head with a big eye, the nose, the mouth. Can everybody see that?
Oh, yeah.
You see it better here? See his eye, his nose, his mouth. And look up here in front. He's got a hand like this. Right? It's the other hand. Right? Like this. And he's holding on to a CD. That's his thumb here, and that's his hand. Okay? He's holding on to a CD. They figured those guys are at CD technology level. We'll burn them one. So they burned us a CD, and sure enough, on the CD is a string of a binary code. What happens when you play that CD? Well, that binary code was decoded, and here's what it says. Be aware of false gifts, their broken promises. This was last summer. Have we seen broken promises this year? Oh my God. This is very interesting. Much pain, but still time. Certainly a message of hope for all the people that have been working towards a new way of doing things on this planet. Yeah. Believe there is good out there. And then we oppose deception. And the end has a bell sound. This is an ASCII code, so there's a bell sound typically to end a transmission. So I haven't had time to work on this so much because I'm publishing a unified field theory with a lot of math and a lot of work in it. And so I haven't had time to work on this, but I am convinced that there is an underlying code as well in this. Because these capitalizations are actually part of the code. So if you only read the words that are capitalized, you have false, broken promises, pain, belief, good, OP, deception. I don't know what OP deception is. Could be other people. It could be many things. But go ahead.
Are the capitals at the beginning of the sentence as part of the code?
Yes, they are.
How about the office of the president?
Office of the president. Office of President Deception. We definitely have seen this year.
Does the bell sound have a certain frequency?
I don't think it does because it's just an ASCII code, you know, that gives a bell sound. So I don't think it has a specific frequency to it. So this is a direct communication, my friend. Go ahead.
You kept saying it's date.
Yeah. Well, it's August 15th, I believe. I'm not sure on that. You might have to verify. And I've been going on the net this year to see the crop circles of August, and the page is not updated past the 10th or the 11th. So, you know, I'm anxiously waiting to see if there's been another message this year you know, direct binary message. There's been many crop circles this year.
Usually, apparently, August 15 is always close to this radio telescope.
I'm sorry?
Is this close to radio telescope?
Well, it's in England. The two that we saw, the two first one were right beside the radio telescope. The third one is further from the radio telescope, but then again, it's right beside a huge repeater antenna, which implies communication. So here, we're being talked to directly. They are getting closer and closer to contact. We're going to see this afternoon a little bit more of the influence that other species in our galaxy may have had on our planet early in its evolution, and how that relates to our current physics, and how that relates to the physics that I'm presenting to you today. Because there's a direct relationship. And it has to do with some of the monuments that are found all around the Earth. So when you look at this, there is crop circles all around the world that are telling us about this structure of the vacuum. But when you look at nature, see, the proof of the pudding is that in this case, all of nature is included. Because, you see, if you take Einstein field equations, for instance, there is no human being that live in that world. There is nothing in Einstein field equations that describe how you got here. Okay? That you can't put human beings in there. If you look at quantum equations for subatomic particles, there is nothing in that world in which you exist, neither. It's all probabilities. But if you have a unified field theory, then it should include all of the biological resolution. Okay? Well, when you look at biology, when you look at nature, what do you see? You see highly organized systems that generate fractal structures everywhere. Where is the fractal coming from? Look at the branch of a tree. They're all fractal structures. Look at the way the grass grows. They're all fractal structures. The way plants grow, the nervous system of your body, the veins of your body, all fractals, all very specific fractals that obey actually the phi ratio.
Okay, I just saw the time. It went crazy. I was so excited about this. All right, everybody. Well, I really hope you enjoyed what we did tonight, and we'll have to continue this next week. And this is a good combination where we get to grow and learn more things at the same time we do the work of transmuting that which has been done without love. So we'll just say a quick good night tonight because of the time. And in a brief a loving, centered note. The I Ching this week is enthusiasm. It's number 15. It's you, Y-U. And it means thunder above, which is Chen, and earth below, which is Kun. And the wisdom is we are asleep. Oh, no. Thunder comes. We are awake. Oh, yes. And the beginning of an era is in play. Thunder roars from the belly of the earth, so deep and so loud that it feels like your pelvis is rattling. And in many ways it is. At the pelvic floor is the energy of the first chakra. It is pure, unadulterated excitement, signaling that the time of the great excitement is here. So gather our tribe around us, celebrate that the time of arrival is here. Let us balance enthusiasm with spirit, and we are renewed. So it is, everyone. And we'll see you tomorrow, and more to come. Thank you, thank you, thank you. And inshallah, we are all another ourselves. Sat Nam.
Sat Nam Ji.
Ahom Itakuyasa. Namaste. Music Maestro. Thank you for the extra time, Commander.